Okay. I'll start. How's that? Better? Okay, so, still sounds loud to me. All right, so at the end of the last lecture, I spoke with a bunch of students and became apparent that a number of you do not have not seen the ADS-CFE correspondence basically ever before. And there was a request that I return to discuss the basics again, slower and with more details. I'm going to do that today, and because I really do want to get to the quantum foam, because that's the sort of sexy stuff at the end. So what the organizers have done is I will return to basics today, recovering some of the material from the previous lecture and some more things at the end. And then tomorrow I will give two lectures, the one that was scheduled and another one in the evening that will hopefully cover the remainder of the material and get us to where we wanted to get by the end of the lectures. Okay, so at least I think the organizers said the evening lecture would be at, I don't know, 6:15, 6:30, 6:15? Okay, they'll announce it. Okay, great, so that's what will happen tomorrow. So in the meantime, when I start doing this, I'd like to make one request of all of you for something you didn't do yesterday. Listen, if you don't understand something, you've got to ask me a question. And don't be shy, because if you don't understand it, there are 15 other people in the audience who don't understand it either. So you've got to ask questions now. I can assure you that the lectures next week, for example, by Steve Schenker is back there, and Ofer Aharoni, will use the things that I said yesterday and today, and will assume that you know them. So for the remainder of the school, and for your health, mental health, and the remainder of the school, be sure to ask questions. Okay? Good. So let's return to the beginning of the things I said yesterday. And I'm not going to motivate while we're doing this. I'm just going to start discussing the ADS-CFT correspondence again. Those of you who are experts will be bored silly. Okay. So here's the ADS-CFT correspondence. So it's a correspondence between quantum gravity, or string theory, in spaces with a negative cosmological constant, and field theories that do not have gravity in them at all. Once again, let me remind you what ADS spacetimes look like. ADS spacetimes are basically cylinders. These are universes with a negative cosmological constant, and I'm always writing down the maximally symmetric such spaces. And a popular way to write this is as here, minus secant squared rho dt squared plus l squared d rho squared plus l squared tan squared rho d omega squared. As I said yesterday, if you stand in the middle and throw a ball away from you, what happens? It comes back. Yes, the geodesics in this space are of two kinds. One's a finite energy, so to speak, of massive particles bounced back and forth. There are very particular geodesic trajectories that go from one boundary to the other, and there are some that go like this, but the normal stuff, like baseballs or whatever else, bounces back and forth. That's the structure of the geodesic in the space, and that's very important for the physics of anti-de Sitter space. There was another coordinate system which we wrote down that we will also frequently use. That was called the Poincaré patch. And what does it look like on this picture? Good. Various people did this. Yes, it's a wedge. And it's useful to remember this, because if you look at this, in the global coordinate system, the boundary of the space is a cylinder. Basically, you go to rho goes to pi over 2 here. And as you go over there, you have the time, and you have the omega, so the two of those combine to make a cylinder at infinity. So by cylinder here, we mean if this is ADS d plus 1, the boundary at infinity will be an S d minus 1 cross time. Okay? So that's what we mean by the boundary, that it's a cylinder. In this coordinate system, once again, the metric is minus dt squared plus dx squared plus dz squared over z squared. Z goes to 0 is the boundary. And can someone tell me what is the boundary in this coordinate system? Everyone? Flat. Does everybody agree with that? Louder. Yes, it's conformally flat, yes. But do you see that? You go to z goes to 0. I mean, it's important that you absorb this kind of stuff now. I had thought that you had absorbed it before, but since we're going to do it now. As z goes to 0, this conformal factor in front of the metric gets bigger and bigger, but the rest of this is just simply, if you look at fixed z slices, you get t and x, and that's just r d minus 1, comma 1. Okay? So you get a flat boundary. So the assertion is going to be, as we develop it further today, that string theory in the interior of this full space-time is dual to a field theory that lives on the cylinder at the boundary. That's a loose way of talking. It lives on a cylinder that's conformal to this cylinder at the boundary. And that if you work inside this Poincaré patch, the physics inside that can be described by a field theory that's defined on the boundary of the Poincaré patch, which is indeed the Lorentzian plane. Okay, that's going to be the assertion. So in string theory, again, to remind you something I said yesterday, in string theory, of course, since we live in 10 or 11 dimensions, you don't just get ADS spacetimes. You get something else that goes along with it. And the thing that goes along with it will always be important for the detailed physics of the spacetime. So the ADS, for example, in type 2B string theory, there is a solution, a maximally symmetric solution, which is ADS 5 plus S 5. This has a negative cosmological constant. This is, of course, positively curved. And this has an isometry group, SO4, 2. And the way you realize that, for example, is by recognizing that ADS 5 is a solution to the equations minus u squared minus v squared plus x squared, plus x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x1 squared to x4 squared is equal to minus l squared, embedded in a space of signature 2, 4. And from that, you can infer this isometry group times S5. What's the isometry group of S5, of a 5 sphere? SO6. So this space has SO4, 2 plus SO6. So if we propose any duality between some field theory and a string theory on this space, the field theory must have a symmetry group, SO4, 2 cross SO6. You have to match symmetries minimally when you have a duality. Other examples, one that we will use is ADS3 cross S3 cross T4. This is also in type 2B string theory. There are various examples you can find from M theory. And as we said yesterday, if you want to reduce the amount of symmetry, be it global symmetry, supersymmetries, whatever else, in the system, what are some of the things you can do to reduce the symmetry in this system? For example, we said orbifold, so you can make identifications of the S5 so that it isn't a full sphere, but only part of a sphere, by identifying coordinates in it. That will reduce the symmetry from SO6 to something less. You can make identifications in ADS5. You can replace the S5 by other manifolds of constant curvature. This is an important thing to do if you wish to study theories with lower supersymmetry, for example. So these are all tactics that you can use. For our purposes, it's not necessary for us to reduce the symmetry. Ofer, next week, will be doing that quite a bit. So I will let him take over from here. We will primarily concentrate on this example and think more about why and how there is a duality. Okay, so first of all, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make again the statement of what the duality is supposed to be. And then, since I understand that you guys many of you have not heard where the duality came from, I will give you a brief description of why we should believe there is such a duality, and then I will build up evidence using various things for the rest of the talk. So the duality is actually difficult to state directly in string theory, and there's a technical reason for that, so I'll mention it and then move on to discuss this in field theory and in the semi-classical limit. The difficulty is, all of these spaces, when you write them down as solutions in supergravity or in string theory, arise somehow from the physics of D-brains, and they always come equipped with various kinds of Ramond fluxes floating around the space. And string theory, the actual worldsheet string theory, is hard to formulate in Ramond backgrounds. There is a formalism called the Berkowitz formalism that one might use to study this, but it's difficult. So I'm not going to try to formulate this duality in generality in the full string theoretic setting. Instead, let's go to the field theory limit of this duality. By the way, there's plenty of evidence that the duality extends into string theory, partly through the work on PP waves, et cetera, for the experts. But let's not bother with that now. I just want to set up what the duality is supposed to be. So duality requires an equation between two theories that tells you that every observable you can compute in one can be computed in a different way in the other. Duality symmetries are things that completely rewrite and rearrange the variables in which a theory is written while leaving the underlying physics the same. So here we have two theories. So let me look at these examples here. We have two theories, which are string theories in 10 dimension. We're going to take the field theory limit of both of them. So we've got some kind of field theory in 10 dimensions. And on the other side, which includes gravity, by the way, we're imagining that at least at some level we treat gravity as sort of an effective field for the moment. And then on the other side, we supposedly have a duality with an honest-to-God field theory. And the way this is formulated is as follows. Let phi be all the fields of the bulk theory. You do a path integral, if you like, over all the fields in the bulk theory. So here it is, e to the I s phi. Now, this looks a bit like a partition function. Partition functions have to be functionals of something. Normally, what we do is we add sources in the partition function for various operators that we might be interested in and construct a partition function as a functional of the sources. Instead here, we require that the fields approach certain boundary values j on the edge of the space-time. So here's ADS space. We integrate over all fields as they approach whatever the values we've chosen, j, which may be functions of the boundary on the edge of space. We set up the path integral like that. And this is now a functional of these sources, j. And this is set equal to the generating function of correlation functions of some dual field theory. That's a statement of what the correspondence is. So this theory is a conformal field theory. And it's a conformal field theory basically, this is defined on the boundary of the space. So if you start off with ADS 5, then the boundary is four-dimensional. And the reason why this winds up being a conformal field theory is we said the symmetries have to match. And in the bulk, you have this isometry group, SO here, SO 4, 2. Here, that would be SO 2, 2. In general, it's SO, is the appropriate SO D, 2. That's the conformal group in one less dimension. So you know that whatever theory you match up with has a conformal symmetry in it. OK, all I've done here is to state the correspondence. I'm going to try to justify where it comes from now. Yeah. Absolutely. The question, very good question. The question was, just as you can reduce the symmetry in the S5 by, say, orbifolding or, you know, otherwise mangling it, can you reduce the symmetry in the S5 side? Yes, in many different ways. Let me list a few, and some of them I will talk about, and some of them Ofer will talk about next week. One way of reducing symmetry in the ADS side, on the ADS side, is to take an orbifold of ADS. Nothing stops you, right? You construct the orbifold of ADS, which is a well-defined procedure in string theory. The string theory is supposed to be defined. And then you can ask the question, what is the dual description? Is there a dual operation? Is there still a dual to the space-time? One example of such a thing that we will discuss probably in the next lecture, maybe not, depending upon the time, is the BTZ black hole in three dimensions, which is indeed an orbifold of ADS3. With less symmetry, doesn't have the isometry group isn't the full conformal group. The isometry group just contains a couple of U1s. And it's still true that there is a duality, okay? In most such cases, even if you break the global isometry group, the asymptotic symmetry group, at least locally, will tend to remain remain this way. So basically, if you tell me, okay, so this is a correspondence that is supposed to apply to asymptotically locally anti-de Sitter spaces. All over here, I'm talking about spaces that anti-de Sitter all the way. But an asymptotically locally anti-de Sitter space is one that, as you go near infinity, in small local regions, looks like pieces of this space or something else. So any such space that you choose to write down is, with suitable symmetries, if it's realized in string theory, is likely to have a field theory dual. So the statement is much more general than simply saying that it applies to a particular ADS5 versus S5. Okay? So, and by the way, just another way of breaking some of the conformal symmetry is just to create a star in the system. The moment you have a star, you've broken many of the symmetries, right? Because there's something there. And yes, you can describe excited states of the system too, as we will discuss more. Did that answer your question? Wait, who asked it? There you are. Okay, good. Thank you for the question. Excellent. So the first thing I would like to discuss before proceeding on to recap some of the things I said yesterday and then sort of build up the details in more detail than yesterday is, why would one propose such an idiotic idea? This is a 10-dimensional theory of gravity. This is a 4-dimensional field theory I've claimed, and I've claimed there's equality. And it seems insane from the point of view that these are different numbers of dimensions. This contains gravity. That doesn't contain gravity, etc. So where would this idea come from? I'll discuss that next. You had a question. About what? Theta? O. This is an O. This thing's supposed to be an operator. So let me be specific. The field phi is dual to the operator O. And we will be much more specific in about 10 minutes about how you find which operator is supposed to be dual to which field phi. By the way, this time I was going to list some reviews. So let me just list a series of reviews on the subject. So there's 99.02.131. Thanks to Itai for pointing out this review, which he found useful. There's 99.05.111. These are all in HepTH. This is the five-author review that contains lots of information. There's 03.09.246, which is a TASI lectures. And for everybody in this audience, I very highly recommend that you read 98.02.150, which was a paper by Witten called Holography and Anti-De-Sitter Space, something like that. It's a really beautiful paper. And it's actually extremely clear and lays out much of what's been said in the reviews also in a much more compact form, and you'll enjoy it. It's a beautiful paper. I recommend reading that. OK. Much of this information is there, so yeah. Ah, thank you. Excellent question. I put an expectation value, but then you have to ask the question, what state? At the moment, the way I've stated this, it's in the vacuum, because I'm going to do this, well, it's in the vacuum. We will later discuss what we're supposed to do to discuss. I will not, during these lectures, explain in detail what you're supposed to do if you want to compute expectation values in a state. But I will give you the relevant references when the moment arises, because there are important subtleties in dealing with states. OK? Next. So let me see. Where does this come from? So I'm going to give a somewhat schematic argument, but hopefully you will at least see the logic of where this came from. So let's start out with the physics of D3 brains. And I'm assuming that all of you at least have seen something about D brains before. And D brains, as you know, are space-time defects, which are quantized by open strings. So there's some membrane sitting around somewhere, and the open strings fluctuating on them quantize it. Can someone tell me, if I look at the low energy physics of a D brain, what is its low energy effective description? I mean, what theory gives a low energy effective description of a D brain? What's that? It's a U1 gauge theory. Anytime you have open strings, the low energy description of the open strings is going to be some gauge theory that's localized on the surface on which the endpoints of the open string live. Okay? So if here I have some 3+1 dimensional whirl volume, the low energy description of this thing is going to be, well, it's going to be some gauge theory, 3+1 dimensions, F squared. If there are many D brains, I'll get an SU gauge theory, as I hope someone would have covered last week in the perturbative string theory lectures. So you'll get a trace F squared. And then it depends in detail about which brain you're talking about, et cetera. But in this case, for just D3 brains, you get the n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. So there are some fermions. There are 6 complex scalar fields, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you get an SUN, well, in general, you get UN gauge theory if you've got n of these D brains. That is the low energy description of a stack of D brains. However, we also know that there is a different low energy description that you could have also given. So consider the metric ds squared is equal to f to the minus 1/2 minus dt squared plus dx squared plus f to the 1/2 dr squared plus r squared d omega 5 squared. When I write down this metric, in order to find this metric as a solution in, this is in the 2b string theory, the space-time is also permeated by various fluxes that I have not written down in detail. In any case, an F here is equal to 1 plus Q over R to the fourth, where Q is proportional to some charge N. You can show that what Polchinski showed when he invented D brains was to show that the charges carried by this geometry were the same as the charges carried but this string construction with open strings ending on something. That is the basis of the identification of dbrains as the quantization of you know, objects like this, that this is somehow the weak string coupling or the small limit of things like this. Okay. So now, consider taking the near horizon limit, as it's called, of such spaces, by which I mean either I could take r goes to 0, so I focus in very, there is, I should have said, r equals 0 is a horizon in the space. This metric can be extended beyond r equals 0, but I have not done so here. The near horizon limit can be taken to r goes to 0, or if you don't want to formulate it in that way, fix r, namely stand at a given position, and take q, in other words, n, to infinity. Right? N here, the charge n here, is related to the number, is the number of dbrains that's appearing here. If you do that, what you find is ds squared is equal to r squared over square root of q minus dt squared plus dx squared plus square root of q over r squared times dr squared plus r squared d omega 5 squared. Okay? I need an eraser. Can people see if I write here? It's not blocked or anything, right? Okay. Okay. So now I'm going to make the coordinate, I'm going to set square root of q equals to l squared. Q has units of length to the fourth, so now l has units of length. And I'm going to set z equals l squared over r. If you take 2 minutes to do the exercise, you will see this converts this metric that I've written down, the near horizon metric, to L squared times d omega 5 squared. That's a 5 sphere with a scale set by L, plus L squared over z squared times minus dt squared plus dx squared plus dz squared. Do you recognize this metric? Can someone tell me what this metric is? Who said that? Someone else tell me who this metric, what this metric is. Mega, what is this metric? What's that? Great, someone else tell me what this metric is. Why aren't you all shouting out the answer? It's right there, okay? You see? So you see, the near horizon metric of this stack of dbrains, of this stack of pbrains, as they're called, was Poincaré ADS. So now the logic that underlies, and I'm not going to justify this in detail, the logic that underlies this conjecture at the time that, that you know, these two things are equal goes as follows. You say that I have D3 brains, and that at low energies, on the one hand, these things can be described, so this is all going to low energy, as Super-Yang-Mills theory in 3 plus 1, I'm doing this specifically for D3 brains, in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And on the other hand, at low energies, this thing can be described as, a supergravity solution. Supergravity. And I should also specify, Q is not just proportional to N, but it's also proportional to G string. So when are these two descriptions? What's that? Is that better? Okay, so this is supposed to be supergravity here. Now, when is this description valid? This description is valid when Q here is sufficiently large enough to give features in the geometry that are bigger than the string scale. Basically, if you send Q to 0, or you send G string to 0 in such a manner that this thing becomes very small, right? If Q goes to 0, you can see that this metric becomes the metric of flat space. And it's in that limit that you're supposed to use this description, okay? So basically, in the limit where the charge is so small that you don't notice it as a gravity solution, you would describe it using it as a dbrain. Now, however, you could do the following thing. You could send G string to 0, the string coupling to 0, so that you can quantize the system as a system of dbrains. And at the same time, you could crank the charge up so the G string n stays fixed, so that the whole space-time metric remains invariant while you go to weak coupling. So that's a sort of large n limit. And in that limit, what we've just basically argued is that these two descriptions, one in gravity and one as a collection, as a field theory, have an overlapping regime of validity? Well, in that case, if they're both valid, they must be equal. Okay? That is the basic argument underlying the ADS-CFT correspondence. All right? So now, of course, you can read that argument and say, wait a minute, you know, what have I missed here? There must be something kooky going along. And then that is the work of justifying. So this was the argument that Maldacena gave in his original paper on the subject. And in subsequent years, people worked out a specific formula of this kind and then gave evidence that such a thing could actually be true. Questions? Yes. The what? Yeah, I should have been more specific here about stating this in this way as n goes to infinity, right? So this is specific to n goes to infinity in the way I've stated it. However, you can try to go away from the n to infinity limit, and there is considerable evidence that's accumulated that if you just restrict yourselves to physics on this near horizon geometry, namely on the anti-de Sitter space, that the string theory on that anti-de Sitter space is actually equivalent. I mean, even at finite n, if you like, the string theory is equivalent to this field theory, even at finite n. There's been evidence that's been steadily accumulating to that effect. Notice that there's a gap in the, I mean, there's a sort of funny thing in the logic there, right? We started out with D brains and described by open strings in this way, by, if you like, closed strings in this way. We derive a certain relation, and then we find this relation is actually valid beyond n goes to infinity, provided you stick with just the relationship between the field theory and this gravity. There's nothing wrong with the logic there. I mean, it's just derived in a particular way. Okay, so again, just to finish, this is so basically the low energy limit of large numbers of D brains, the near horizon limit of large numbers of D brains is supposed to be equated to the low energy limit of the theory on the world volume of the D brains. And that's, of course, a very powerful way of trying to generate new dualities. You could take your favorite stack of D brains, stick it on your favorite, you know, singularity in a Calabi-Yau or something like that, proceed to take the near horizon limit of the low energy limit and try to generate in that way new kinds of dualities between certain field theories that live on D brains at certain singularities and various space-times. And people do that all the time. Just a quick comment, this whole setup is a version of a very ancient duality in string theory, namely the open-closed duality. Consider the one-loop diagram of string theory. If you read it this way, this is an open string going in a circle. If you read it this way, it's a closed string going in this line. And you can argue that this is some version. It's that relation between open and closed strings that is coming out in a particularly subtle and beautiful way in this setting. Any questions about the setup? What about the coupling of the D brains to the closed sector? Very good. So in this setting, of course, the D brains couple to the closed sector, right? So for example, this string can, I can draw the disk diagram for the string, which involves an emission of a closed string. Otherwise put, that's a whorl sheet that looks like this. Yeah, that's an allowed whorl sheet that has one boundary here. So why doesn't that matter in this limit? That I have not justified to you carefully. That's where I said I was cutting corners in what I said. You have to justify that when you do the series of limits, the closed string sector decouples from the open string sector. I mean, that is really the key of finding out that there is such a duality. And I haven't shown that to you. I recommend reading some of the reviews that I have said, because I have to move on if I need to cover anything more in this lecture. Everybody happy? One more, and then I will move on. Yeah. Yes. The redshift associated with going towards the horizon is related to the comments about coming to low energies on the field theory side. And it's a nice thing. So an exercise that I think would be very valuable for you is to work through all of those details of the logic. It's fun and it's very beautiful. I'd go back to the original paper on the ADS-CFT and also to the review articles, and you'll see some of these arguments laid out. But I hope this gives you an idea of where to start. Okay? I'm going to move on. So next, now that we agree that it may be plausible that such a thing exists, the next thing is to sort of set it up in detail. So that is what I will now do. How am I doing on time? Okay, good. Perfect. Okay, so okay, very good. So I think the best way for us to make some progress as to how this thing is supposed to be set up in detail is to start looking at the details of one particular example, ADS5 versus S5, which anyway occurred in Sujong's lectures and will occur again and again in next week's lectures. So I'll try to set up how this correspondence is written in that case and provide some justification for it. So let's take the example of ADS5 versus S5. Okay, so ADS5 plus S5 is supposed to be equivalent to, so this is a 10-dimensional string theory, which we make Kaluza-Klein compactify on the S5 and talk about, you know, the 5-dimensional ADS space, but there's really an S5 floating around. It's supposed to be equivalent to the N equals 4, and I'll explain what that means in a moment, superconformal SUN Yang-Mills theory on the boundary of ADS5. Okay, so let's just decompress the notations. The N here, in the rank of the gauge group, is of course related to the N that we had there. The super is there because these solutions of type 2B, I should say type 2B string theory, because the type 2B string theory is supersymmetric. How many supersymmetries does this preserve? Well, this solution happens to preserve all the supersymmetries of type 2B string theory, so there are 32 supercharges. It's an N equals 4 superconformal because this is 4 dimensions, so 4 times 4, so supercharge is 4 components. You have 4 times 4 is 16, but it's superconformal, so the conformal part adds certain superconformal charges. So all told, you wind up having 16 fermionic symmetry, 32 fermionic symmetry generators on this side and this side to match things up. The parameters, and you can derive all of these parameters by going through these limits carefully, which I'm not doing. So I'm just going to state the parameters and then try to see if we can understand them a little bit more. So these things have a scale. ADS space has a scale, and the sphere has a scale, as I set out there. The scale L is related to G string times N to the power 1/4, precisely for the reason of that near horizon limit thing that I was saying there, times the string length. The Yang-Mills coupling, G squared Yang-Mills, is directly related to G string. G string N, which is the Toft coupling, I will use the letter lambda, is of course then the parameter that controls the scale of the ADS space. So if you need the ADS space to be large compared to the string size, or equivalently if you want the sphere here to be much bigger than the string length, the limit you should take is N going to infinity, G string small, but the Toft coupling kept large. Sujong, in his lectures, described the Toft limit of Yang-Mills theory and discussed many things, I think, about how that might motivate some description of a large N Yang-Mills theory as a closed string theory. In his discussion, he would have defined G string N, G squared Yang-Mills N, as the Toft coupling. And when the Toft coupling is small, when lambda is small, there is a perturbative expansion of Yang-Mills theory in planar diagrams. That is a very powerful tool in, for example, studying QCD. Here we're studying the opposite limit. The Toft limit is large. So there isn't a perturbative expansion just in planar diagrams, and the basic statement being made here is that all the diagrams, many, many diagrams that you would have to perturbatively sum over, and not just planar ones, in the Yang-Mills theory, in this limit of the coupling, are summed for you by the bulk gravity. That's the statement. In the old days, there was a statement that large N Yang-Mills theories are described as so-called master field, that there is a certain classical configuration of field somehow that controls all the dynamics of a large N gauge theory. What's happening here is the supergravity is working as the master field in some sense of this Yang-Mills theory in 4 dimensions. So your 4 dimensional theory seems to have a 10 dimensional master field in some suitable sense. Anyway, let's list some more things. As we said earlier, the Bok spacetime has an SO4,2 cross SO6 isometry group. This is from the ADS side. And this is from the S5. Now, in the ADS, in the field theory, this turns into the conformal group, because the conformal group in 4 dimensions is SO4,2. and this is the R symmetry. You have Phil Argyris has not discussed theories with extended supersymmetry so far. He may not have time to do so. But if you have more than one supercharge in your theory, you could imagine that there may be a symmetry in your theory that, if you like, rotates the supercharges amongst each other. Such a symmetry is called an R symmetry. And interestingly, this SO6 rotation group of the S5 manifests itself as an R symmetry. In tomorrow's lectures, we will use this R symmetry in great detail to construct states that break half of the supersymmetry of the theory and therefore wind up being under particular control. Okay. Now, okay. So let's discuss the semi-classical limit. So far, I've been sort of talking about the sort of field theory setup. But of course, this field theory setup is still extremely messy to handle, because here I'm talking about a path integral over all the fields of, I don't know, the low energy fields in string theory or something, over 10 dimensions, including the graviton. You know, that doesn't really make sense. As we know, the field theory, a field theory of gravity doesn't really make sense. So this equation, when it's used, is typically used in a limit where we're talking about the semi-classical limit on this side. So what is the semi-classical limit of the correspondence lead to? So how do you get to the semi-classical limit? The semi-classical limit must involve L over L string or L Planck going to infinity. So, well, H bar goes to zero, or equivalently, N goes to infinity. So we're always going to talk about a sort of large N limit of the theory. And in that limit, this thing will settle down to its saddle points. So the idea in this limit is that you construct the saddle points of this action. In other words, the solutions to the equation of motion subject to the boundary conditions of the fields phi approach some value j. And then you write down e to the I s classical on the classical saddle points of that thing as a function of j. And that gets equated to e to the I w of j, which is simply a notation for this thing. Namely, this is the generating function of correlation functions of the field theory. I said this again yesterday. And I'm just writing it again. So now this is equivalent to the statement that the claim is, if I take the nth derivative of this classical action with respect to j, remember j here is the boundary value of the fields, of the string theory fields, or the gravity fields in the bulk space-time, this is supposed to be equal to taking n derivatives of this, the generating function, this is supposed to give you the endpoint correlation function. So that is the basic formula. Now, to explain what this means and to get some experience or confidence with it, what we need to do is we need to talk about, some details. You know, what does this action look like? What does this thing look like? How do particular fields get mapped to particular operators? And how do we do these calculations? That's what I'm about to start doing. But I will pause for questions. Yes? What's that? Oh. With j equals 0. Thank you. If I don't pick, that is the way in field theory, when we use sources to compute correlation functions, we introduce a source, we compute the response of the theory to the source, and then we vary, and then we remove the source. If you don't set j equals 0, that amounts to taking the field theory, as we will discuss later, and leaving the source with a non-zero value. That amounts to taking the theory, S of the Yang-Mills theory, let's say, and deforming that to be this plus integral JO, right? It's as if you don't set J to 0 at the end of that, you have extended the action by the addition of an additional term. That will give you some deformed version of the conformal field theory, of the N equals 4 theory. That is actually a very useful tool that people do use. So for example, I have not discussed the details of the theory yet. I will in a minute. So this Yang-Mills theory has a certain, the N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory that we've been talking about has a certain superpotential. By adding various other terms to it, you can break the supersymmetry from N equals 4 down to N equals 1. Well, that's a very nice thing to do because, you know, N equals 1 supersymmetric gauge theories are, in some sense, more interesting because they have less supersymmetry in them. And you can say many nice things about the relationship between N equals 1 supersymmetric gauge theories then and theories of gravity. Ofer, I think, may discuss some of those things. Yeah. Okay, that's a very good question, actually. Sharp eyes. I'm not going to answer your question in detail. For the following, I'll give you an answer to your question, but there's some issue there that I don't want to address. The answer to that question is the following. The U1 degree of freedom in the UN describes a center of mass motion of the brain. In the construction that's being done here, you are, by construction, going very close to the stack of brains, by construction. So if the brain moved, you would move, in your procedure, you would move with it to stay close to it. So by doing that, you've effectively lost the U1 degree of freedom. There was a paper by Aharoni and Witten which explained also the U1, the disappearance of the U1 in more technical terms, and you may want to look at it. But the way I understand it is the way I just said. There was one more, and then there was a question there. Yeah. Yeah. Well, 16 times 2. Well, it's just you have to ask what representation these things transform under. And as it turns out, you know, they transform under a certain representation of SO6. I mean, that's what it works out to be, right? Just because you have a certain number of supercharges doesn't mean you line them up in a row and then multiply them by a big matrix. The theory does whatever it does depending on what its Lagrangian is. And so, well, there's a, what it turns out that the R symmetry is SO6. Yeah, something like that, yeah. Well, he's asking why does the R symmetry wind up being SO6 and not something else? Well, you know, it does because that's the way the theory is constructed. Yeah, there was another question. Yeah. 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 So the expansion. Yeah. Okay. So, excellent. Question is, you can construct expansion. I mean, there are many expansion parameters here. There's G string, there's L string, there's ADS scale, etc. So G string expansion is a string loop expansion, right? Right. As you get handles and everything, you get more powers of G string. That's the 1/n expansion here. So remember here that what you have here is that there's a large n limit, and then the n is infinity. So this is not the Toft. That's not the Toft n. That's not the Toft end. Right. So let's look at that. So first of all, G string is directly related to G squared Young Mills. Right? So loops in G string are going to get related to loops in the corrections in G squared Young Mills. But then as you see here, L string is related to the ADS scale divided by G string n to the 1/4. So if you keep the ADS scale fixed, right, and then play games with and then modify L string in your theory, then you're talking about expansions in some quantity of that kind. So what you want to look for in the Yang-Mills theory is effects that depend then on the Toft coupling, right? Some constant and the Toft coupling. However, notice that it's a fractional power of the Toft coupling. In perturbation theory, you're simply not going to see any effect that goes as G string n to the 1/4. So that's never been fully understood from that. I mean, it's clear that, you know, at strong coupling, you can get lots of effects that modify the dependencies of coupling constants and stuff like that. But in the perturbative analysis, if you just think to yourself and how the loop diagrams of the Yang-Mills theory go, you will not see a G string n to the 1/4 dependence. But there are many cases where if you compute naively, so for example, in some of the Wilson loop calculations that Sujong would have told you about, if you compute various quantities in the Yang-Mills theory, you know, perturbatively, you'll get a dependence on G string n. But if you just close your eyes and replace the dependence, you know, take each G string n and raise it to the power of 1/4, so G string instead of the thing, instead of just taking G string n, you will reproduce the answer that you would have gotten gravity correctly. So there's something very peculiar about going to the large Toft coupling limit that seems to replace in certain calculations, or such that the only effect in some calculations appears to be to replace a dependence on G string n by G string to the 1/4. That's not understood. Okay. Any more questions? Good. Actually, let me verify. Yesterday, people didn't have questions, but then afterwards, had questions. Any more questions? Are you sure? Can I hear a yes? That wasn't enough yeses. Can I hear more yeses? Because otherwise I'll start picking on people who don't say yes. For example, you haven't said yes. Right there, with the Coke can. You. Yes. Is it fine? Good. Then say yes. Excellent. Okay. So, well, I want to keep going to build up more of the details here, just to get this completely embedded for my lectures tomorrow and for the lectures for next week. So once again, let me repeat, in the semi-classical limit, we are supposed to say that e to the I times the classical action as a function of the boundary data, which I'll maybe write as phi naught of b or something, is supposed to be equal to e to the I generating function of correlation functions in the CFD as a function of the boundary data. And here, let's stick to the ADS5 setting. So this is the n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory. OK. So what is the left-hand side? The classical action is supposed to be d5x. I'm not going to write down the full Lagrangian of the gravity theory in five dimensions. But you know, the first few terms are obvious, since they're always the same. There's the Ricci scalar plus d5 squared plus blah, blah, blah. You can work in Einstein frame. You can work in string frame, do what you like. But in the end, the action is the same. There's some action that involves some scalar fields, some fermions, some gauge fields, some form fields, some Ricci scalar. And because there's an S5 floating around, let me remind you that if you start off, for example, with a dilaton in 10 dimensions and Kaluza-Klein reducing the S5, there will be a complete Kaluza-Klein tower of states coming from 10 dimensions, right? So for one massless dilaton in 10 dimensions, you will get one massless field in 5 dimensions plus a full tower of integrally spaced masses, OK? That will become important in a minute, so I'm just reminding you. On the Yang-Mills side, what's the action? Okay, so we have a d4x, trace f squared. There are some fermions. I hate fermions, so I'll ignore them, and I'll just call them this. There's an adjoint scalar fields. There are, in fact, 6 adjoint scalar fields, 6 5 i's. These transform, these adjoint scalars transform as a vector under the SO6. That will become important very much tomorrow. And you know, let me see. There's a curvature coupling. You take the curvature of the sphere, multiply that times phi squared, phi I squared, summed on I always, of course. There's a superpotential that there's a cubic superpotential. There's some commutative terms here. Okay. So that's the Yang-Mills theory. So we're supposed to be able to compute this on this if we it's a strong coupling. So we can't really compute everything on this side, unless they're protected by supersymmetry. And on this side, it's a classical system, so we can calculate pretty much anything you want. This is the usual situation in dualities, where one side gives the answers to some questions easier than the other side. OK, very good. So as I said, this contains g mu nu, scalars, etc. So I want to specify further what this thing, OK, so this contains g mu nu, scalars, and the gauge fields, etc. We've already talked about the relationship between the symmetries here and here. Here there was the isometry group here was related to the conformal symmetry and the R symmetry there. We've already said that. And the additional thing I want to say is, so what do you do in this conformal field theory to do calculations? What's the interesting thing to do? Well, what you do in this side is you build composite operators from a mu, psi, and phi I. And, well, compute their correlation functions. That's what you do in a field theory. So an example of a composite operator is O is equal to trace F squared. Right? That's one of the operators of this theory. So in a CFT, the thing you do is to calculate correlation, or the thing you can do in an easy manner is compute correlation functions of such objects. OK. So when we write down this equation, where is the equation? The equation is gone. When we write down the equation that dn, ds classical, d phi naught n, 1 over n factorial evaluated at phi naught equal to 0, is equal to the expectation value of some operators, the kind of operators that we mean on the right-hand side are operators of this kind. You take polynomials of the fields of the Yang-Mills theory with all Lorentz indices contracted, obviously, all gauge indices contracted, obviously, so you have a gauge invariant, Lorentz scalar kind of object. You compute its correlation functions in the vacuum, and then you relate that to some calculation on the other side. That's supposed to be what you're supposed to do to check the correspondence, shall we say. But if you want to do that, the first thing you've got to establish is the dictionary between all the fields here, the graviton, the scalar fields, et cetera, and the composite operators that you could have written down on the Yang-Mills thing. Okay. So let's make a table. Composite operators. Oh. For a reference on how you're supposed to think in this language, I again refer you to a paper by Witten. This was in 98, 0215. There's a section where he starts building up this dictionary, and many people followed and built up the dictionary in many, many other cases. But, well, this is the same paper I referred to earlier. It's a beautiful paper, and that's where I learned some of these things from originally. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to tell you what the map is for a few fields, and then we'll discuss. And I'll use this map later to do some calculations to see how this goes. So suppose phi is a dilaton in the bulk phi b theory, a massless dilaton. This is related to the operator trace f squared. Let a be the axion of the phi b theory. That's related to trace ff tilde. Right? Let gij be the graviton of the bulk theory. That's related to tij, the stress tensor of the dual theory. The stress tensor is, of course, a peculiarly important operator in any field theory, so we will have much more to say about that later. Then there are the Kaluza-Klein modes of phi. Namely, for E, for the dilaton, you have this full massive power of states coming from the S5, and that's related to operators like trace F squared times X to the K, where, let's say here, X is equal to phi 1 plus I phi 2. You know, some complex combinations. Okay? So you can construct operators of this kind. So as you can see, this is the way. So how do you find this dictionary? Well, you've got to do a variety of things. You've got to match charges, masses, symmetries, etc. And one of the calculations that I did yesterday that I will not repeat today was to show you in ADS 3, for example, that if I give you a map between in ADS 3, I showed you that if I look at solutions to the weight equation for some field, then the full tower of solutions is organized in representations of the conformal group. I showed that yesterday, and I'm not going to repeat that today. Okay? So in that case, in the field theory, if you had likewise found, let's say, the operator trace F squared that is dual to the dilaton, basically, the excited states of the dilaton are mapped onto operators that are conformal descendants of the operator trace F squared. And it's obvious that if you've matched this to this, which I will do in a minute, I haven't yet matched it for you, I've just told you this is match. If you've already done this match, then the higher excited states of phi will get mapped to this conformal descendant. So symmetry will give you most of what there is to say. In the paper, in this paper, if you go read this paper to see how this matching is done, what the basic first evidence for the correctness of this, of the ADS-CFT correspondence, was that you can just, there are tables that people have written down. I'm actually not remembering who is the authors of the paper. There are tables where people enumerated entire families of operators in the N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, their charges, their conformal dimensions, their various properties. And there were other papers where people worked out full towers of masses for fields in the space-time and their charges and things like this. And so one of the basic first pieces of evidence was in this paper, it was pointed out that if you looked at all of these towers of fields and states and gravity, they matched up one-to-one with the towers of operators that you could construct in the N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory. So in other words, you remember, for this equation to be true, for each field in space-time, there must exist an operator in the dual field theory, right? If that doesn't work, as a one-to-one correspondence, the conjecture would have been dead. But in fact, there is a one-to-one map between the fields and these operators. So I'm not going to develop in detail how you map every field to every operator. But the one thing I do want to discuss is matching the masses of fields to the conformal dimension of the dual operator. So that you at least get, at the end of it, you should at least get some idea as to why the dilaton would be mapped into an operator like trace F squared, which happens to have conformal dimension 4. So why does the dilaton map to this? At least you, I hope you will get some idea of that. Let me just check how I'm doing on time. Good. Back. Fine. So let's study a scalar field. And in particular, I want to study a scalar field that has a mass m, scalar field of mass m. And I'm going to start thinking about the physics of the scalar field in a bulk ADS5 spacetime, or ADSD. I'll just do this in general for ADSD plus 1, ADSD plus 1. And well, so I'll start thinking about the physics. And then you'll see I'll find a way of relating the mass of that field the conformal dimension of a candidate dual operator. So let phi be the scalar field. Its equation of motion will be box phi is equal to m squared phi. I had some exercises that I wanted you to do, and I can't find them. Box phi is equal to m squared phi. And let's work in Poincaré coordinates. Just for fun, ds squared is equal to l squared over z squared minus dt squared plus dx squared plus dz squared. This is identical to what I did yesterday, but I think it went by too fast for some people, so I'm repeating some of it. So now I can Fourier transform this as e to the I k dot x minus I omega t times chi, because there's a translational symmetries in two directions. And then I get to plug it in into the wave equation to get an equation for chi. And that equation winds up being z squared dz squared chi plus z dz chi minus m squared plus d squared over 4 plus k squared minus omega squared z squared chi is equal to 0. Does anybody recognize this equation? Yes? What is this equation? It's actually Bessel's equation. That's of course, box phi is sort of like a Laplace equation, but this is Bessel's equation, which a solid training in classical math will embed into your brain like a firebrand. Anyway, so this is Bessel's equation. So because it's Bessel's equations, Bessel did all the hard work for us some 200 years ago. That's very convenient. We should always hope for such things to happen. And, oops, let me just look at solutions now. Phi is equal to e to the I kx minus I omega t. Z to the power d over 2. Remember, z goes to 0 is the boundary of the space-time. Times some coefficient a, j nu of qz plus some other coefficient phi naught times y nu of qz, where q squared is equal to k squared minus omega squared. Now, of course, this is the Bessel function, this is the Neumann function, and an immediate question you should ask me is why I picked that basis, not some other basis. You know, there are lots of linear combinations that are still solutions to Bessel's equations, and I will try to give some hint on that now. Let us look at this as z goes to 0 near the boundary of the space. And it becomes more or less a, well, there's a z to the 2h, a times z to the power 2h plus, I'll define this in a second, times a plane wave plus j times, oh, what letter am I using here for the boundary condition? I guess I'm using phi naught. Well, let's change this to j. J times z to the power 2h minus times e to the ikx minus I omega t. Okay. So when I define h plus and h minus in a minute, it'll become evident why I chose to make this split. By the way, of course, I've picked that split also in a way that the j and the y are orthogonal functions. Okay. So 2h plus minus is d over 2. And this is, as I said, in any general ADS, d plus 1 plus or minus the square root of d squared plus 4n squared over 2, which is d over 2. I'll define that as d over 2 plus or minus nu, where nu is the index of the Bessel function. What did I forget? I don't think I needed to. Yeah, I think I changed notation somewhere on the way. Thank you. It doesn't matter. What's that? Yeah, it's not going to matter. Well, q squared bigger than 0. Yeah, okay, so what do I want to do? Maybe this is minus this way. If you prefer that, that's fine. Well, I'm taking the absolute value, but the absolute value there, all I want to mean here is that take omega squared minus k squared. Omega will be bigger than or equal to k, I guess, and then you just compute this. It doesn't matter what you put in there. The issue that you are interested in for the singularities, that'll come back in a second, and I'll deal with it. It has nothing to do with q. Okay. Okay, so this is this split. Now, I want to say, notice that h plus, for sufficiently large masses, 2h plus is bigger than 0, and 2h minus is less than 0. Okay? There's a subtlety having to do with masses that are less than 0, m squared less than 0, which can happen in an atom de Sitter space. There are fields that can have mass squared negative and still be stable. I'm not going to discuss that at all, where you have to modify my discussion a little bit, but essentially the same physics holds. As far as I'm concerned, mass squared is bigger than or equal to 0 for the rest of this talk. But be aware that there is a range of masses, m squared less than 0, that can happen, and that's interesting. Yes, question? What's that? J? I'll talk about J in a second. So because of this, notice that this first term here is going to 0 as z goes to 0. So this term is vanishing, and this term is diverging. So if I were to draw a picture, I would draw the picture like this. Here is anti-de Sitter space. The first one, the thing that goes like A, is doing this, and the second one is doing this. So as a consequence, if you compute the norm of these states, compute phi comma phi is equal to integral root j gtt phi dt phi, basically the Klein-Gordon norm, you will find that this thing has a finite norm and this thing has a divergent norm. And what that tells you is that you can use, you know, A's and A daggers if you like to canonically quantize these modes, but you can't do that for this. This you can't canonically quantize. So this is called, in the lingo, the normalizable mode, and this is called the non-normalizable mode. We will have a lot more to say about this in a second. But what's clear is that these normalizable modes can be fluctuating modes in a canonical quantization of the theory, whereas this thing can't. So what is their status? So the idea is that, remember, what we were supposed to do in the formula for the correlation functions is to fix the boundary conditions for the field at the edge of space, right? We said the field approaches some value j at the edge of space. So what you're supposed to do is you fix that boundary condition by turning on one of these modes, if you like, that approaches some value j at the edge of the space. And these are modes that can be allowed to fluctuate around that background. Remember, I'm always here working the free field theory, so I solve this as a free wave equation. But really, you know, there are interactions and things, and you can include those interactions and correct this discussion for that, but I'm just not even going to bother. Right? In philosophy, you understand, I hope, what is going on here. You will always find these two solutions that act this way. Having said that, there is, however, a subtlety that we should immediately deal with. Actually, should I deal with the subtlety first? Or should I? Yeah, there's a subtlety that we should deal with. We won't deal with it yet. Your question is related to that subtlety. So I will come back to that in a minute. Let's just stick with this for a moment. Otherwise, it'll be confusing. OK. So based upon this, since these things can fluctuate, there are obviously some kind of states in the system, whereas these things are some kind of boundary conditions. So the way we talk about that is we say that the normalizable modes are related to operators acting on the vacuum to create states. So each normalizable mode is related to some state. Whereas the non-normalizable modes are, well, it depends how you use them. You might use them to compute correlation functions by, you know, turning them on, computing the action, differentiating, and then setting them to zero. In which case, you know, that's what you use them for. But if you actually honest to God turn them on and insist on working around a background where these non-normalizable modes, if you like, are turned on, then you understand that in the following way. You take the action of the CFT and deform it by the addition of the operator, whatever the boundary condition was, J-O. At this point, someone should be squawking that, wait a minute, the boundary condition isn't that the field is approaching J. The boundary condition is that the field is approaching JZ to the 2H minus, and this is diverging. So actually, you know, the boundary condition is infinite. What does that mean if you say that the boundary, if this is what I want to say? We will have more to say about that later. That has something to do with the fact that if you actually compute the action for any of these fields, you actually find that it diverges, and that you have to renormalize in order to get finite answers. And that renormalization is essentially kind of canceling out the effects of this growth. Another way of thinking about this is the conformal field theory in question, I've been stating, is defined at the boundary at infinity. Well, the boundary at infinity is infinitely big, right? And these issues with this thing growing are related with that thing being infinitely big. So you have to always, to do your calculations, you have to rescale, or, you know, wild transform the boundary to a boundary of finite size, and that will remove these z to the 2h minuses. And that's one of the subtleties of calculating in this framework that I will talk about in a minute. But anyway, so for our present purposes, pretend this isn't there, if you like, as far as the boundary condition is concerned. Our prescription is we cancel this out and then take the j. All good so far? Yes, no? OK. So what I'll do now is I'll make one comment about, you know, states, operators, and conformal dimensions, and then I would like to argue why it is that this quantity 2h plus that we've written here, so 2h plus is going to wind up being equal to the conformal dimension delta of the dual operator, and I want to argue why this must be the case in a minute. Before I do that, let me just make a slight aside. Massless particles will do the same thing. If you look at this, m is equal to 0, you get d over 2 plus or minus d over 2. So you will get 2h plus is 4, and 2h minus is 0. Right, so you'll find that this is not going to infinity. It goes to constant. That's why I said that once you get m squared less than 0, we have to start saying all of these things in a slightly different way. I just don't want to do that, because that, you know, that'll take the rest of the... Already I'm running out of time, I guess. Hold on a second. I should just carry this in a pocket. What time did I start? 2:30, right? Okay, yeah. Yeah. What's that?
Patience.
Okay. A quick comment I want to make is all along I've been talking about the conformal dimensions of operators, and I just want to make a little clarification. So we use the language of conformal dimension of operators in the Euclidean setting, but in the Lorentzian setting, this is on the cylinder, this is actually the energy of the operator, or the Hamiltonian that we're talking about. Let me just remind you how that works. in a two-dimensional CFD in two dimensions, well, in a two-dimensional CFD in Euclidean signature, the metric is dr squared plus r squared d theta squared. That's the space-time background. And the conformal dimension is the eigenvalue of the dilatation operator, which is rdr. So now if I want to go to Lorentzian signature, this is Euclidean, if I want to go to Lorentzian signature, what I'll do is I'll set r is equal to e to the t, which means that ds squared becomes equal to e to the 2t times dt squared plus d theta squared. Then I'll remove this because of the conformal field theory, and I can conformally rescale anything I so please. So I do. And then I'm going to take t to it, in which case this is the Lorentzian cylinder. In our case, the analogous construction would give us the Lorentzian cylinder being a sphere and time. Okay, right? I mean, that the global boundary of the space-time would be of ADS space-time as a cylinder. So in that setting, if you ask what delta equals RDR maps to, by the time you go through all of this, that maps to DT, which is the Hamiltonian. So the reason I'm saying this is in much of what I have to say tomorrow and what people will say in subsequent lectures, people will be working in the global ADS space-time where the boundary is a cylinder, and they'll use the words conformal dimension all the time, but that's, in that setting, the conformal dimension has been mapped into the Hamiltonian. It's DT, okay? And I'll need that at various points. I'll use the, and there will be a map between the mass of a state in space-time, and I will often use a map that this goes to m times the ADS scale is equal to the conformal dimension of the dual operator. Why that's the case will become more clear in sometime tomorrow. But I just want to emphasize that okay, the energy maps in this way. Okay. Now, I want to discuss why should 2h plus be the conformal dimension of an operator that appears, of the operator that's dual to this state. Okay, so here's the way to go about this. Okay, so let's again work in these Poincaré coordinates, since that's where we've been constructing these solutions. And again, the metric is minus dt squared plus dx squared plus dz squared over z squared. So let me draw a picture. Remember, we drew global ADS space as a cylinder, and the Poincaré patch as a wedge in this way through the cylinder. Let me take a diametric slice through that, because I don't like drawing 3D pictures. And I'll draw global ADS this way. And the Poincaré patch is this wedge. And there we go. So if you go to position z equals epsilon, it's this surface here. And z equals 0 is a surface at infinity. Z equals infinity is this is the horizon. Okay, that's the picture of what's going on. So let me go to z goes to epsilon. So it's clear that as you move around in z, this metric undergoes a scale transformation, right? As you go to z goes to 0, it scales to infinite size. As you go to z goes to infinity, it scales to 0 size. And so motion in the space-time is implementing a scale transformation of the CFT. This is how the field theory, how the scale transformations of the field theory get realized as a geometric construct. It's a motion in the space. We'll have much more to say about that later, because from this you can immediately already see that motion deep into the interior means, you know, making epsilon big. That means shrinking the metric. That means going to the infrared in the field theory. Like this is going to come out again and again and again. The interior of the bulk space-time is the infrared of the field theory. Okay, so now consider this non-normalizable mode that we have been talking about. That looks like jz to the 2h minus times some stuff. The way, because these things diverge as you go to infinity, the way you're always have to calculate is you cut off the space-time at some z equals epsilon, do all your calculations, regulate, remove the divergence, and then move back to z equals 0. Okay? That's the way you have to do your calculation, just because this annoying thing happens to go to infinity at the boundary. Okay, so the proposal that we have made thus far, so this is a regulation of the CFT, so that, as I said earlier, when you compute actions, et cetera, you don't get infinite answers. You calculate, and then you move the boundary away to infinity. The proposal we've made so far is that adding a non-normalizable mode should be a deformation of the action by the addition of some operator. Actually, let me write this out in greater detail. So this would be d dx square root of h integrated over the boundary. H is now the metric of the boundary. So let's say h mu nu is the metric of this boundary surface times phi non-normalizable times some operator O whose dimension, let's say, I still haven't fixed. By the way, any time I write any expressions like this, you should always covariantize properly by throwing in the measure and contracting indices, et cetera. I will always leave that out because it's always understood it's done. So let's see. As you move the surface around, how do the various things here scale? There's a square root of h here. So if you look at the, if you think of z here as epsilon, the square root h. Oh, so by the way, what's h mu nu, the boundary metric? I just drop the z, and the rest of it is the boundary metric. So if you look at the determinant of that, this thing here scales as epsilon to the minus the dimension, d, of the boundary. This thing, because of the 2h minus appearing here, scales as epsilon to the 2h minus. And this thing, well, scales as, let's say, epsilon to the alpha, and we want to figure out what alpha should be to give us a well-defined theory. Okay, so to keep the scale invariance of this, since we should put in this thing in a scale invariant way, we need then that epsilon, we need minus d plus 2h minus plus alpha is equal to 0, or alpha is equal to d minus d over 2 minus nu, that was 2h minus, which of course is equal to d over 2 plus nu, which is 2h plus. So we've just discovered that to get a deformation of the CFT that scales in the correct way, in other words, it doesn't scale, right? It doesn't care where you put your boundary to define the theory, right? I mean, if you want to define a sensible deformation of the original theory, it can't depend on how you chose to regulate the theory, right? So if you want to do this in a regulation-independent way, you must choose the conformal dimension to be 2h plus. That's what we just learned. Okay? So now you know where that comes from. So now, okay, so that's another comment. And now I want to address the subtlety the gentleman over here has been asking me to deal with. Okay, so all along here, I've been sort of talking as though there's this clean division between the normalizable modes and the non-normalizable modes. But notice that the non-normalizable modes, if I take phi non-normalizable, your favorite choice of one such mode, and then add to it an arbitrary sum of the normalizable modes, this is still normalizable. Non-normalizable. Because since that was governed by the divergent behavior at infinity, well, if you add something that converges at infinity, it's still non-normalizable. So the question is, what linear combination should you pick, right? I mean, you need a basis of these things that fix your boundary conditions. Which linear combination should you pick? Okay. So remember that in our setting we said phi, the field phi, could be written as A times a Bessel function j nu qz plus j times a Bessel Neumann function of qz. Let me rewrite that as the boundary condition j that I wish to implement using these non-normalizable modes times a over j, which I will rename b, times j nu of qz plus y nu. So if you examine this, you will find that in general, y nu is singular. Okay, so here's what we do. So here's what we do. Okay, so if you take the way field theory is defined is by going to the Euclidean section and then coming back to the Lorentzian section. So if you take T to IT, and so that the momenta here appropriately width rotate, and then you ask what happens to these modes, you will find that this Neumann function is in general singular, but has a singularity that's exactly canceled by these things if you pick this coefficient in the correct way. So what you're instructed to do is to pick that particular linear combination of these two things that is non-singular in the Euclidean section. So that's the way you define what linear combination you should take. So if you pick the non-singular combination, then the object that you get, it's a special class of these non-normalizable modes, then those things are called the bulk boundary propagator. Another way of saying this is that if you go to Euclidean signature and work out the unique non-singular solution to the equations of motion in the Euclidean section, and there's only one in that case, you will find that reproduces a particular combination of these things. Okay? So that it's the unique combination that in the Euclidean section that's non-singular. So this is just like going, you know, to the Euclidean section to figure out what a Feynman propagator is, and we'll see that there's a, you know, that's correct. So in particular, the particular combination that comes out is k nu, the Komar function, I forget, one of the other Bessel functions which has some other name. So it's a particular combination that comes out. And if you look in the references that I cited earlier on, in particular 98, 05, 171, this will be set out, and the correct combination will be derived. So I'd like to suggest an exercise. It's added material to this lecture. It's going back and forth. So there's an exercise that is very instructive, and which you can also get out of the literature, so you will have help doing it. Where is this? So the exercise is this. Repeat this analysis in global ADS space. Namely, what I've just done is in Poincaré ADS, and I've worked out the Bessel equation, blah, blah, blah. And this is all, each step has been elementary. It's just massing up, and you'll feel much more comfortable if you do it once yourself. Repeat this in global coordinates. You know what the metric is because I wrote down earlier. So you just solve the wave function for scalar fields. Find that you will find that the solutions are hypergeometric equations, and then make this division into normalizable versus non-normalizable modes, and see that everything works out in exactly the same way. So you would just follow these steps one by one and see that exactly the same thing works out. And in that case, the issue of the singularity is much more apparent, because in global coordinates, the spectrum is quantized, so you will see that at the energies that are not quantized, both of these things have an obvious singularity. Both modes, the two modes you'll write down, will have an obvious singularity that will cancel together if you pick the correct combination. It's actually easier to think about in the global coordinates. So I suggest looking at that in particular for your question. Okay, so I have 4 minutes, and there's so much to cover tomorrow that I'm going to take the 4 minutes. Keep going. Before I do that, though, are there any questions? Yeah. Don't ask me about this because I need to move on. Yeah. Okay, excellent. Any more questions? Questions? You promised to ask some questions. When I promised to give this lecture, you promised to ask some questions and you haven't. Okay, excellent. So I want to discuss some issues before we finish today of doing quantum field theory in this situation. We basically set up this division between the two kinds of modes. We understand something about how to set up the bulk to boundary propagator to compute correlation functions in CFT. We'd like to understand a little bit more about modulo your confusion. And we'd like to understand a little bit more about states and their excitation from the system. And then we'll call it quits for today. Okay. So first of all, another thing that we have to specify in order to make progress is what's the vacuum of this theory. And in an anti-de Sitter space, as I said earlier, the vacuum is unique. In many other kinds of, in de Sitter space, it isn't unique, for example. But here, if you pick a state that is annihilated by all of the symmetries, isometries of anti-de Sitter space, you'll find that the state is unique. So that's helpful. So the next ingredient we need is the Feynman propagator, dz prime. B will be coordinates parallel to the boundary, and z is a bulk coordinate. So here's a slice of anti-de Sitter space. We want to know the amplitude for propagating from one point to the other. You can compute this in many different ways. One way is to sum up over all the normalizable modes of the correct weights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The other way, that the one that I usually do, is to Wick rotate Euclidean section, solve the equation box phi is equal to delta function with the correct boundary conditions, and that object will be your Feynman propagator when you Wick rotate back the Euclidean section, or to the Lorentzian section in the normal manner. So let's suppose we've done that. That's the Feynman propagator. What's that? D prime. Prime. Now, one thing I can do with this is I can take the limit z goes to 0. And you can take z to the minus 2h plus times the Feynman propagator of bz, b prime, z prime. The reason you need to do, you put this in, is the following. Of course, the Feynman propagator is going to vanish as you go towards the boundary, because all the normalizable modes are dying out, so this will too. And so what's being done here is to remove the rate of dying off in this way to get some object, which actually turns out to be the bulk to boundary propagator, the same object that we described there. This is another way of describing it. So this then, so this is G. Feynman, the bulk to boundary propagator describes propagation from the boundary into the bulk. It's a very useful object for the same reasons that we've said here. And it's very satisfying that it is, in fact, the boundary limit of the bulk Feynman propagator. It clearly has the right kind of meaning as far as propagation of data from one place to another place. So now that means you can assemble this into correlation functions. You can use the bulk to boundary propagator, thread it together with other propagators, et cetera, and you'll get expressions then. What I'm writing down is, remember, earlier we wrote down the path integral expression for the ADS-CFT correspondence. Then we took the semi-classical limit and talked about the semi-classical description of the ADS-CFT correspondence. Now I'm going to give you the perturbative description of the ADS-CFT correspondence, how perturbatively string together vertices to compute whatever you want. And so, for example, if you have the correlation function OB1 through OBN, you'd write down an expression just like what we would do in field theory. You string together bulk to boundary propagators, from B1 through X1 to the bulk to boundary propagator, B2 to X2, da da da, all of these things for every line coming in from the boundary to the bulk. The propagators are the ones relevant for the field in question. So, the propagator for the graviton is an ungodly mess. The propagators for form fields and fermions took pain and suffering and many months for people to work out. But anyway, you can get them all in the literature. Times the Feynman propagator, et cetera, x1, x2, et cetera. So this is times vertex factors. So this is the perturbative expression. What this computes for you is a boundary S matrix for the space-time. Right? The bulk space-time has this boundary. And as I said earlier, yesterday, the Cauchy problem is not well-defined because there's a time-like boundary. So you can basically insert stuff in here from infinity. So the kind of S matrix that one should seek to calculate is, suppose you insert some things into ADS space, and then you eat it back out at the boundary, what is the amplitude for that to happen? That is the question that you can ask in ADS space. Just like in flat space, the kind of question you would ask is you inject stuff from past infinity and it goes out to future infinity, and you can ask what is the amplitude for that to happen. So what this computes for you is such an S matrix, a scattering amplitude for things going in and things coming out. And you can read about this in gory detail, and the connection to flat space S matrices, et cetera, in these two papers, 9802150, 9902052. And references there, too. Both these papers have lots of papers that cite them. So I'm going to say one more thing, and then we will finish, because all of this machinery, although very powerful and very beautiful, is clearly ponderous and difficult to use. And tomorrow, in the next lecture, we will discuss, you know, renormalization of these things, which is also, you know, difficult to do, and there's lots of subtle points. So it's very convenient always to find at least some quantities that you can calculate practically in the back of an envelope. Right? That's very helpful. So what I'm going to describe is one such thing, and then we stop. So suppose you want to use this formulation to compute two-point functions. For a conformal field theory, two-point functions are trivial, because the two-point function for a conformal field theory is governed by its by conformal invariance, and you know what the answer should be already from conformal invariance. But if you break conformal invariance by deforming the theory in some way or by adding a state to the bulk, etc., then in fact it can be an interesting thing to probe what the state or the space-time is like. Okay? So it's an interesting thing that you might want to compute. And Steve Schenker will be using this kind of thing next week to discuss, you know, probing behind the black hole horizon and stuff like that. So you should pay attention. So I wish to compute the two-point function OB, OB prime, between two points on the boundary. What am I going to do? Well, according to the perturbative description that I've given here, the way I do this calculation is I take the limit of z and z prime going to 0, because that's the boundary limit, of the Feynman propagator, GBB prime, z, z prime. I'm basically saying, you know, here's the bulk propagator for going from here to here. You take these two points to the boundary, and that'll give you the quantity that you want. We could do this in a different way. We could, in fact, construct a solution to the wave equation for the field dual to the operator O, construct the action and differentiate twice. And I'll say more about that in the next lecture. But this is the easy trick for doing it. Okay? So this is what we should do. Notice, in principle, I should be removing some factors of z. Okay? Because this thing is actually going to go to 0, and we need to rescale that. But I'm not going to do that. Let's just forget about that for the moment. Now, this is a Feynman propagator. So famously, a Feynman propagator has a path integral expression of the following kind. Suppose you want the amplitude to go from there. You literally sum over all paths that a particle could take to go between these two points. Right? I'm not doing field theory path integrals. I'm doing path integral for a particle to go from one point to the other point. So I sum over all paths, e to the I, the mass of the particle doing the motion, divided by h bar, times the length of the path. So, I mean, what's this? The length of the path is literally integral dt square root of dx mu, dx nu, g mu nu. Since people often learn these things backwards, let me remind you that when you look at the Nambu-Goto action in Polchinski, the Nambu-Goto action measures the area of a world sheet that's propagating. This is simply the one-dimensional version of that. It's the length of a line that's propagating in space. And, you know, this is the first of the path integrals that was written down. Okay, so let's take the semi-classical limit, h bar goes to 0, or notice m goes to infinity. So what I'm going to say applies both for very heavy particles and applies in the semi-classical limit. That's the same thing. In those limits, this will settle down to the paths of least length, right? But the paths of least length are famously the same things as the paths that are straightest, which are the same thing as the geodesics of the space-time. So this thing is going to be more or less the same thing as the sum on all geodesics, e to the I m over h bar L of g. There's a, you can read about this in the paper 99.06.226. Okay, as I said, when you do this, of course, the geodesic length between two boundary points is going to infinity, but this is actually going to 0. So, well, okay, so you've got to mess around here to remove these factors of z, but I'm not going to talk about that in detail here. So this is a sum on geodesics. Okay, so let's just draw some pictures. Suppose you want the correlation function between two points that are close by. So in other words, UV correlation function. The geodesic will do this. Suppose you take points that are far away. But this is an infrared correlation function. The geodesic will do this. You immediately see that two-point functions in the infrared probe further deep in the interior than do the UV two-point functions. And this can be a very powerful tool. So for example, in this paper, some attempts were made to sort of talk about collision of defects and things like that using this language. Don Morolf had a nice paper afterwards using, for which I don't have the reference. Anyway, there's a paper there. And Steve Schenker will talk about the content of his paper with Ugri and Krauss, 012277, next week, about seeing behind the horizon with these techniques, in case you want to read up on it in advance. You may find this first reference useful to set up the philosophy in advance. Okay. Almost done. Okay. So now, what is the time? Oh, I'm over. Let's stop here. It's a good stopping point. All right. Went slower.